name of this particular presentation is Fish Story, Salmon and the Redemption of Creation. Have we got anybody here that likes to fish, first of all? I need to know.
Well, where's my dad? I told him to come.
Well, okay. I like to fish, but I'm not that big a fisherman. I just fish in Texas.
And I think you'll understand what I'm going to be trying to talk about in here. It's always hard. People ask me what this is about, and I never know how to say it. So I guess you're just going to have to listen to it. But this has got a text to it, and the text is
like
one
a sermon. You start with that.
That's right. You start with a text, and we'll come back to the text. But this is one that you probably heard in one of the weeks after Easter, because it's from the Gospel of John, and we always read from the Gospel of John in the Easter season. But this is one of my favorite. I think this may be my favorite passage in Scripture, but it's in John 21, which is sort of a postscript on the Gospel of John. It ends at the end of chapter 20, and then it goes on again. So, and this is how it goes. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "Well, we will go with you." They went out and got into the boat. But that night they caught nothing. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in for the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his clothes, for he was stripped for work, and sprang into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish lying on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So the way this starts off is with that passage by Simon Peter, who says, "I am going fishing," which is John 21:3. And sometimes when I leave my campus ministry office, I put a note on the door, and it says, "Leave a message. John 21:3." So if people are biblically literate, they know what I did, and if they're not, they can look it up. Right? So, and I guess I'll just relate this pretty much the way I have it. It was originally written as an article, and I think I'll just stick with that, because if I try not to, I'll get bogged down. The first time I ever saw wild fish was in the summer of my 25th year. And the power of that experience has stayed with me to this day, and in some very important ways has given shape to the way I look at life, to theology and ministry. I was on my way west on a post-adolescent odyssey in search of myself, as the saying went in those days. Maybe some of you remember those days when you were searching for yourself. The immediate occasion for this particular journey was my impending internship in Tacoma, Washington. When I was growing up in North Wisconsin, I had always dreamed of having an opportunity to try out my fly fishing skills on the rivers of Montana and the Pacific Northwest. And so places like the Yellowstone River, the Madison, the Henry's Fork, the Fire Hole, and the Big Hole were names on a map that I would just spend hours looking at. And then Dan Bailey's Fly Shop, if any of you are fly fishermen, you know that place. It's in Livingston, Montana, and that was sort of the sanctum sanctorum of my boyhood dreams. You know, if I could get any place, it would be to Dan Bailey's Fly Shop. To this day, every time we go through there, I always stop at Dan Bailey's Fly Shop. It's sort of like a pilgrimage I have to make. So when the opportunity presented itself to go to my internship, I gave myself about 6 weeks to take a 3-day trip. You know, I had plans. And so short on money, but still long on enthusiasm, I holed up in a remote cabin that was owned by my uncle in the middle of the North Cascade Mountains of Washington. And actually, it was in a valley that's just over the hill from Stehekin, over War Creek Pass, if you know that area. It was up on the Twisp River. It's really a rare and beautiful thing to be alone in the mountains in August. The days are long and sunny, and the nights are mostly cool and clear, and there's just a hint of the coming fall. The heavy runoffs that we experience in spring are over, and the fishing is just really beginning to get good. In Wisconsin, we used to start fishing in May. In the West, you really can't start fishing till the end of July or August if you're fishing in the mountains, because there's too much runoff, and it's just impossible to fish. I remember that in the mornings, I would rise fairly early, and I'd head for the river in search of rainbow and cutthroat trout, which are the trout that are in this part of the world. In the afternoons, when the sun is real high and it's hard to fish, I'd sleep, or I'd read, or sometimes I'd write. And after dinner, I'd sit out on the front porch and I'd watch the deer, who would gather at a salt lick, which was over on the edge of the meadow that was right in front of this place, and then I'd listen to the sounds of the river, which was just beyond. For about 3 weeks, I really never saw another human being. The only time I can remember using my voice was to howl at some coyotes who were out one night in the moonlight just beyond the meadow. And I remember that they were howling back, and for about the next hour and a half, one of the strangest experiences I've ever had, we carried on this sort of raucous antiphonal chorus, howling at the moon. Maybe I was crazy. A full moon always seems to bring that out, and it brings it out in people as well as coyotes. I can't really tell you why I went up into the mountains alone that summer. When people would ask me, I'd say it was an extension of my fishing pilgrimage. But if it were only fish that I was after, I'd passed up a lot better places in order to get to the one I was at. The fishing was really pretty marginal where I stayed this time. There seemed to be something more that was sort of drawing me to this place, and it was almost like a religious experience. Years later, I read a passage in a book that some of you may be familiar with called The Klamath Knot, by a man named David Raines Wallace. And it kind of helped me interpret something of what I'd been experiencing that year. This is what he says. He says, so many major structures of belief have arisen, at least in part, from experiences that people have in the wilderness. This was to be expected with the older structures, such as animism and shamanism, since the entire world, which was outside the Paleolithic camp, was really a wilderness. But why should all the major modern religions of the world include a crucial encounter with the wilderness? Moses, Jesus, Muhammad in the desert mountains, Siddhartha in the jungle? And why should the predominant view of the origin and development of life have arisen from the 5-year wilderness voyage of a Victorian amateur naturalist named Charles Darwin? There is evidently more to wilderness than meets the eye, more than water, timber, minerals, the materials of civilized existence. Somehow there are mental trees, streams, and rocks, psychic raw materials from which every age has cut, dammed, or quarried an invisible civilization, an imaginative world of origins and meanings, what one might call a mythology. The Indians call such journeys, like the one I was on, a vision quest. But I didn't know anything about those in that particular summer. I was really just paying attention to sort of an inner voice which seemed to be drawing me into the mountains alone. As I recall the experience, I literally stumbled onto the salmon in much the same way that I've stumbled over most truth in my life. I was fishing, and if any of you spent any time fly fishing, you'll know this feeling. I was kind of hypnotized by the sound of the water. You sort of go off into a almost like a meditative state. You're just kind of standing there casting, and you watch the sunlight dance on the riffles, and you think about life and the universe, and I was thinking about how I was going to manage to replenish my dwindling supply of beer that I was kind of doling out for this 3-week period. I was thinking about what I would eat for dinner that night. I was thinking about everything and really nothing, and just sort of hypnotized. And I was picking my line up off the water in preparation to make another cast when one of the large rocks on the bottom of the stream suddenly shot forward 20 feet against the flow, and it stopped next to another rock. And as I stared at that rock, it slowly began to take on the outline of a huge fish. It was really the biggest fish I'd ever seen. It must have weighed 25 or 30 pounds. And as I looked, it became apparent to me that there were other fish, rocks, in the water as well. And it took me a few minutes to realize what I was looking at, but what I was really seeing were spring chinook, who had traveled nearly 1,000 miles, I guess, up the Columbia and the Mettow rivers, and now they were in this mountain river of glacial meltwater, and they'd come here to spawn and die. Like myself, they were on a journey, but they were nearly at the end of theirs, and I was only beginning mine. Throughout history, salmon have been the primary life bringers in this part of the world. What I was viewing was a mere shadow of what had once been. Bruce Brown, in a book called The Mountain of the Gods, writes of a time when rivers like the one I was standing in were almost barren of all life because of the geological and glacial activity. You know, when you talk to Rudy Edmonds and he talks about how the glacier came through and just cleaned out this valley, I mean, there really wasn't anything here except rubble. And this is what Brown writes. He says, with the glacier's retreat 10,000 years ago, the salmon fanned out and recolonized millions of miles of rivers draining into the North Pacific. Spawning at times in the shadow of withering glaciers, the salmon led the return of life to the ice-scarred valleys. They were not the only means by which nature reclaimed the wasteland of gravel, boulders, and clay, but they were among the most important, for they provided the only way of capturing large amounts of nutrients at sea and returning them to the land. Many biologists believe this is why all Pacific salmon die after spawning, unlike Atlantic salmon of the more nutrient-stable East Coast. Running in such numbers that many rivers like the Olympic Peninsula's Hama Hama, which is Indian for stinky stinky, were known for the marvel of their rotting. That's why it's called that, because the salmon ran up there in such numbers and then they would die and it was just, you know, it would stink. They were known for the marvel of their rotting, that the salmon helped recreate the soil which supports the rococo excesses of the modern Olympic Peninsula rainforest. If you think about it, if you've ever been up the whole river valley and you think about the just the incredible amount of life that's in one of those rainforests, and you think about the fact that when the glaciers came through there, there was nothing there, and you think about the salmon as really the life bringers back in there. Brown says at the same time, the salmon attracted animal life. You know, so the other animals would come in to take advantage of the fact that the salmon were there, and that's how life came back to these valleys. In the spring of 1980, in one of the more celebrated geological events of recent times, Mount St. Helens blew up, sending a cubic mile of volcanic debris into the atmosphere. Some of you may remember that day, May 18th, 1980. I know I remember it. That was the day my daughter was baptized, and she remembers it too. As a result of the blast and the volcanic activity that happened, if some of you remember seeing the pictures on TV of the mudslides and the mud coming down the South Fork of the Toutle River, the South Fork of the Toutle got so hot that the salmon and steelhead, according to some people, were literally jumping out of the river onto the bank to get out of the water. You can imagine, you know, these fish are used to water between, you know, 40 and 60 degrees, and if it gets too warm, it's not, you know, very conducive to them. Well, this water was very hot, and they were literally jumping out of the banks of the water. The landscape after the blast, if any of you were up there, was just like a lifeless gray moonscape. I mean, it was just dead for all practical purposes. And the waters of the Toutle ran chalk white with volcanic ash. And there were those who predicted that it would be hundreds of years before they would support any life at all because of the amount of silt, which is not good for fish. Less than 5 years later, though, salmon and steelhead have returned to the upper reaches of the Toutle River, bringing back life to the area that was given up for dead. It's really interesting. I talked to some people since then who, the South Fork of the Toutle was a famous steelhead river in Washington, and there were people that fished it. And in the time prior to the blast of Mount St. Helens, the people that fished the South Fork of the Toutle were complaining about the fact that there weren't any fish, and they couldn't figure out, you know, they should be coming in and they weren't. And the Kalama, which is the river which is south of the Tootle, had all sorts of fish in it that year. The fishing on the Kalama was just absolutely phenomenal. And what they think is, and I think that biologists probably have studied this, but that a lot of the fish that would have come up the Tootle that year almost had an intuitive sense that something was wrong up there, and they went up the Kalama instead, which is absolutely unheard of, because salmon always go back to the stream where they were born in. And yet, these fish, almost as though they had a sense of what was going to happen, in a sense that they needed to somehow propagate themselves. And I don't want to, you know, say that salmon have personalities and all that, but there was something that made some of these fish go up a different river because they wouldn't have made it on the Tootle, which is just, you know, I've heard that anecdotally from people that fish there. And I think that there's, you know, some evidence for that, although I can't put my finger on it, but it's an amazing kind of thing. Anyway, I'm back out on the river now. I remember that day reeling up my line, and I just stuck my rod next to a tree. And then from then on till well after the sun went down, I followed the salmon and watched them go upstream. For hours, I kind of stumbled through the brush as they made their way upstream. And I was trying not to frighten them, but I was trying not to lose sight of them either, because I wanted to see what was going on. I was really captivated by this experience. These were not the bright, fat salmon I had seen in fishing magazines that were being hoisted in the net by a beaming fisherman. You know, you've seen them in outdoor life. It had been many months, in fact, since these particular Chinook had resembled the fish in those pictures, though once they had been every bit as strong and beautiful as those fish. These salmon were dark, and they were battered from fighting their way upstream, up fish ladders next to the dams on the Columbia. Their brothers and sisters had been decimated by pollution and, you know, bad logging practices, overfishing, and dams that really blocked off thousands of miles of prime spawning water in the Columbia Basin. If you think about the fact that, I think it's Grand Coulee, although I might have the dam wrong, but when that dam was built, it literally blocked off thousands of miles of spawning habitat for salmon. They couldn't get past it anymore. I mean, the salmon used to go way up into Canada, almost up into the Rockies, where the Columbia, you know, the Columbia ice fields are, the headwaters. And, but they couldn't do that anymore after that, and that really had a decimating effect on salmon. The males that I was looking at had hooked jaws. If you've ever seen them when they get mature, they get, you've seen pictures of them probably, they get real pronounced hooked jaws. And there's patches of white fungus on their flanks. And they're really not very pretty at all. The females carry thousands of eggs, and their bellies are just, you can almost see them, they're really distended because they're just full of eggs. They'd not been in this particular stream since their birth, and now they had returned to the same place in order to lay their eggs to fertilize them and then die. In spite of their ravaged appearance, there was something incredibly noble and graceful about them as I watched them. They would kind of hang in the pools. If you've ever seen them, they just kind of hang there effortlessly. And then they rest, and then they move up through the next set of rapids, and then they rest again, and you know, they just keep working their way up. And maybe some of you have seen them jumping falls. They're just incredible to watch how they do that. At a certain point during that timeless afternoon, I came upon a piece of water with three pairs of males and females. The tails of the females were nearly stumps from having been used to clear away almost baseball-sized rocks. They need to get down to the gravel, because the gravel is where they lay their eggs, to make a nest, or which is called a red, in which to lay their eggs. As I watched them from behind some alders at the side of the pool, I almost felt like a voyeur at this cosmic rituals. The males and the females performed a sort of a dance. You know, the females would clear away and lay the eggs, and then the males would fertilize them, and they'd kind of go back and forth like this. You almost have to see it. It can't be described with words. When it was over, the exhausted and nearly dead salmon, they kind of hovered there in the aftermath. By the next day, they would be carcasses on the shore, and they'd be food for the bears and the bald eagles, who also made their home in this valley. The bears always come down when the salmon, because they eat them. In retrospect, I probably should have taken off my shoes, for the ground on which I stood throughout this liturgy of life and death was surely the holiest I would ever walk upon. I can't remember much of what took place during the rest of that summer. it didn't strike me until later that I had seen the vision that I had gone off looking for, that I didn't even know I was looking for. In the coming year, I experienced life and death in other ways, but never in quite so pronounced, concise, and eloquent a way as on that silent afternoon on that nameless river in the mountains. Death and life, the cosmic dance, had been played out before my eyes, and like Job, I could only respond in silence. For the indigenous peoples of the Northwest Coast, the life-bringing nature of the salmon was not lost. Bruce Brown writes about them. He says, reflecting on the cycle of their lives, the Indians of the Northwest Coast produced a series of paradoxes to explain the visible world and man's place in it. Many tribes, like the Quinault, told the story called The Boy Who Went to the Salmon Country, which described how a member of the tribe was carried to an underseas world where the roles of the salmon and man were reversed, and he himself was a salmon. The boy was told by his salmon family to go and kill some humans for dinner. When he had done this, the boy was shown the correct way to return human bones to the water so that the people could revive and come back to life after death. This knowledge was the key to the perpetuation of the salmon. And when the boy finally returned to the village, many adventures later, he brought with him tremendous numbers of fish and was thereafter known as the salmon bringer. A lot of the Northwest Coast tribes, in fact, all of them that I know of, have a ceremony that they go through called the First Salmon Ceremony, in which they ceremoniously kill the first salmon, and then they have a special ritual that they go through to return the bones of that salmon to the river so that the rest of the salmon will come. And it's a very moving kind of thing. If you watch the way Indians prepare salmon, they're very careful about it. They never, you know, when you go to a restaurant, sometimes you have salmon steaks and they, you know, you cut, slice it up. A lot of the Northwest tribes won't do that to a salmon. They'll only open them up, they'll butterfly them like this. And there's some religious significance to that. There's probably also some culinary significance to that too because of the way they cook them. But, that's the way they will cook the salmon. They'll open them up this way instead of cutting them into steaks. And I don't know if that's true for all tribes, but I know that's true for like the Makah and some others. Philip Drucker writes of how the Indians created a kind of mythological mirror world. Okay, their mythology was sort of a mirror image in which the central lesson was the emphasis on proper human action as the key to the salmon's abundance. I mean, people have to act properly in order for the salmon to come back. You know, and we say, well, that doesn't make sense. But if you stop and consider that the present plight of Pacific salmon species is due almost entirely to the disregard of you know, mostly by white settlers, I would say, of the ecological realities in this region of the world, you could start to understand the wisdom of that insight. In other words, the Indians were saying you have to live your life correctly for the salmon to come back. You know, biologists say you have to practice good ecological, you know, practices in this part of the world if we're going to have salmon. You got to pay attention to where they live and the habitat. On a more subtle theological plane, Drucker goes on to describe a tale in which the salmon dwell in a large longhouse under the sea, kind of like this other story I was telling you. In the longhouse, the salmon take on human form again. And as the time for the annual run approaches, they transform themselves into salmon, which really mean life for the Northwest Coast peoples. The run was thus conceived as to be a voluntary sacrifice on the part of the salmon for the benefit of humankind. Okay, the salmon were doing this as a voluntary effort. And, you know, the humans' task then was to live properly, to return the salmon's bones back to the river in the correct way, and to kill the salmon in the correct way so that, you know, this thing could keep perpetuating itself. But the salmon were voluntarily giving up their lives so that the people could have life. A sacrifice without which the coastal peoples would have quickly starved to death. And when you think about that passage in Philippians about Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of humankind. You know, it's the same kind of an idea there. Most theological reflection on experience in the realm of nature, which is what this is either written off as nature mysticism. You know, they say, oh, that's just nature mysticism. Don't give me that stuff. Or it's relegated in Lutheran circles, I think, to the first article. The first article is the one that deals with creation. And then it's promptly forgotten about, since our theology is one which is preeminently interested in redemption rather than creation. You know, how many times did you ever go to a church and hear a sermon about creation? We're always talking about redemption, and we mostly focus in on Jesus rather than God as a creator. You know, that's something that, you know, there's reasons for that, and some of them are good, but we think about those as being kind of separate realms. And now, I don't accept that kind of a theological scheme, but I wonder whether the salmon doesn't tell us something rather profound about redemption as well as about creation. I mean, the salmon, in a sense, is sort of a redeemer character in a way, you know, bringing life back to the valleys, giving life to the peoples, giving up the salmon's life so that the people can live and all that kind of stuff. It seems to me like that's not just creation. Well, if it is creation, it's creation in a much broader sense than we usually think about it as. Walt Wangren, who some of you may know, he wrote the Book of the Dun Cow. He's been up here before, but he writes about this. He's a Lutheran pastor, and he's also a very good writer. He says, "This is not a metaphor I'm telling you. This is the truth. God speaks to us in these animals, and the Native Americans know it. That's not them making up a false religion. That is them hearing the word of God through a hawk or through a bear or a wolf. We don't see it, and we don't listen to the animals, and so a great amount of the word of God is lost." He goes on to say, "We who do not hear the voice of God in creation and in the animals, we may come to the truth of Jesus Christ, but we do so by a narrow ladder. We don't hear all that God said first that ended in the name of Jesus. On the other hand, the Native American, or a friend of mine, a Zimbabwean, who was not all his life a Christian, but was a so-called primitive, these people come to Jesus Christ by a mountain, not by a thin ladder." In our Lutheran tradition, the person who probably talks more about this than anybody else, and who does it very eloquently and very cogently, I think, and his books are over in the bookstore and in the library, is Joseph Sittler. I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, but he's got some books. One of them is called Essays on Nature and Grace, and he's got a real neat one over there that's right by the cash register that somebody just compiled of his sayings called Gravity and Grace. And he's always writing about this notion of creation and redemption. He gave a famous sermon once in 1961 at the World Council of Churches called Called to Unity, in which he asked people to see the work of Christ not just in a narrow, personal, human kind of a way, but to think about Christ's work in a cosmic kind of a way. When Christ redeems the world, it's not just people, but it's the whole cosmos, and we need to start thinking in cosmic kinds of terms. It's a very eloquent piece that Holden published, I think, not too long ago, republished. Anyway, this is what Sittler says. He says, "Only when the meaning and the act of redemption is somehow within the web of creation can a salvable entity be saved in any sense at all that makes sense." He says, you can't think about people being saved individually. You know, you have to start thinking about salvation as being something that happens to the whole creation and to groups of people. It's not an individual kind of thing. And he says, you know, try to imagine people outside of creation, you know, outside of their relationships with other people, outside their relationships with the land, outside of all of their relationship with what God has made, and what you end up with is sort of this distorted abstraction of this disembodied mind. You know, he says, you know, that's not even worth saving. You know, when we think about saving people, we have to think of them in terms of this web of relationships, and we have to think about God saving the whole thing, you know, not just this little intellect part of it as an individual intellect. He's very eloquent about that. There's a poet, some of you may be familiar, his poetry books are here in the village, named Richard Wilbur. And he writes a poem which is kind of a famous poem. It's called Advice to a Prophet. It reminds me of some of the stuff we were talking about this morning. But the whole point of the poem is that if you've got something prophetic to say, don't just talk about people, talk about the whole creation. So this is what he says. I'll quote a part of the poem. He's talking to the prophet, and he says, "We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy, The lark avoid the reaches of our eye, the jackpine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's arc, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? What Wilbur is getting at is if you're a prophet and you're going to talk about the danger of a nuclear holocaust, don't just talk about the people that are going to die. Talk about the whole creation that is going to somehow be rendered lifeless. You know, then people will start to understand what it is you're talking about. I long ago decided for myself that an eternity without trout to fish for or salmon to watch was an eternity that was hardly worth thinking about, let alone living in. So since that afternoon in the mountains, I have had many occasions to spend time on the water, like Peter did after the death of Jesus on the shores of Galilee, searching for fish. I find myself constantly drawn to the places where wild fish can be found. And when people ask me about it, I just tell them that I'm going out fishing. But somehow I know that there's more to it than that, though God knows that's more than enough. I go back to John 21. Morning came and there stood Jesus on the beach, but the disciples did not know it was Jesus. He called out to them and said, "Friends, have you caught anything?" Which is a typical thing that people say to fishermen all the time. "You got anything?" And they answered, "No." He said, "Shoot the net over to starboard and you will make a catch." They did so and found they could not haul the net aboard, for there were so many fish in it. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." So, that's my fish story. And if you want, you can tell us your fish story, or we can just talk about that idea of, the larger idea that I want to get at, and it's become for me, I think, sort of a lifetime project, but I want to start thinking about the way that creation and redemption relate to each other instead of abstracting those two things and isolating them out from each other. Because I think when we do that, we sort of get a real diminished view of creation. Be interested in hearing what your thoughts and reflections on that are.
Well, I suppose, whereas you spoke specifically about in the area of fishing, I wondered sometime about those who go backpacking in the mountains.
Sure.
Now I've never done that, and yet there are times when I search out for a simple, maybe a quiet walk, or
sure,
and there's something I can absorb from nature that I don't absorb from a book.
The fishing for me was sort of a vehicle, and it was a way that. It was something that I had a predisposition for in the first place, and it became the vehicle to understand. I was trying to relate it to some other things. And I wrote this last year here at Holden. This was something that took place, 12 years ago now. So, I never really even understood it when I was experiencing it, but it was a vehicle. For other people, it may be something else that helps them to connect. But somehow, I guess what I want to ask us to do in our churches is to encourage people to do that sort of thing. To somehow, treat our, there's been a long discussion in theology about whether or not there's something inherent in Christianity, for instance, that leads us to disregard the creation and to treat it as an object instead of respecting it and trying to live within some ecological constraints. And there was a famous essay by a guy named Lynn White who wrote that he was basically holding that the Judeo-Christian tradition was responsible for the ecological collapse of the pollution and stuff. And a lot of people responded to him and said, "Well, that's too simplistic. That's not the case." But I think the point is well taken that sometimes we've tended to interpret our theology in a way that makes it seem like we're not concerned about God's creation because it's of secondary importance. And what a guy like Sittler does for us, I think, is to say, wait a minute, Those aren't separate things. That's not a different God that created the world and also redeemed the world. That's the same God. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is that there are even some ways in which, you know, they're sort of like, if you want to call it that, mini redemptions. You know, if you were an Indian, you wouldn't say that was a mini redemption. I mean, that's the whole ball game, those fish coming back every year. But you know, some other redemptions that take place, and so that when God is working through Christ, it's not something totally alien to what God does in other areas, that those things are somehow connected with each other. And you know, for different people to come to that awareness happens in different ways, I think. You know, for some people it's being in the mountains. You know, for I don't know how people do it. Some people maybe do it through their art, you know, which somehow links them up. You know, they create and they can understand that, you know, what does it mean when we say that God creates? You know, so it's different for different folks.
Well, wasn't that God's first commandment for us to be caretakers of the earth when we left the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, well, you know, and that's what the discussion has been about, or part of the discussion has been about, is what was God's command to us? Some people have interpreted that you know, in some I don't have a King James version here, but to subdue it, and I think if you look at that, and so you know the whole notion of conquering the wilderness, you know, had a sense in which there was a biblical mandate to go ahead and do that. My sense is that you may be able to read it that way. In certain traditions, but I think there's a larger tradition in Scripture and in that passage too, which doesn't necessarily talk about subdue in the sense of conquest, you know, which is what I think especially, you know, we've thought of it as, you know, conquering the wilderness, and that's still a very real mentality out here. And it's, you know, there's some good, I mean, the reason we're here in some ways is because somebody had that idea about this mind, but more of a stewardship. To be a steward of creation, I think, is what the Bible is talking about. To somehow say, yes, humankind has a different role in creation than the animals, and we're not trying to retreat to some romantic notion where, you know, we don't make use and we don't create and there's no technology. You know, I think that's an illusion to think that we could ever do that. But to somehow think about the earth as a gift that God has given us to be the stewards over, and to use that wisely so that all people and all creation can somehow enjoy the fruits of that. It's not like God doesn't make enough food, for instance, but it's like somehow it doesn't get from where it gets grown to where it needs to be. You know, it's a very simple kind of example of that. Yeah, yeah.
Hearing you talk about the salmon spawning and making uh-huh. the dance,
yeah, yeah.
Just brought back a memory of that I heard from a man about 3 months ago. He and his wife and his in-laws were out on the coast in Washington, and there were about 30 whales, male and females, cohorting. They were hiking, and they came onto a little cove, and they were cohorting and making all sorts of noises as
oh,
they
boy.
Were mating.
That must
20
be.
Or 30 of them. And they stayed there for about 2 hours, just awestruck, primordial. He said that their lives were changed from that experience.
Oh, yeah.
Coming in contact with something was so basic to life. Been going on for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years.
It is a very, I think, you know, that sounds just hearing you describe. I've never seen that, you know. But, you know, that becomes the
hearing
opening.
The sounds and just watching.
And again, you know, the part of what, you know, I got a colleague down in Santa Barbara. He won't mind if I mention this to him, about him here on the Holden tape. His name is Bruce Wallenberg, and he's always giving me a hard time about this, but he says, oh, you people in the Northwest, are you all into nature mysticism, you know? and you know, because you're in a place that's physically beautiful. You know, it's overwhelmingly beautiful. And he says, you all go out and worship a mountain or something like that. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say in a sense is that that's not, what that is a way, it's a way to make what God is doing a little more transparent, you know, to us. And bigger, probably, than we imagine as well.
the less complimentary term is they accuse you of pantheism.
Yeah, right. Yeah, same thing. You're a pantheist. You know, you worship trees and rocks and stuff like that. And it's hard to convince people that you're not worshiping the trees and the rocks. You know, I'm sure he imagines that that's what we do up here in some sort of fertility rites or something out there. I'll take them fishing sometime.
Extreme, maybe somebody does. Is missing the point.
Well, and you can see how for the coast Indians, for instance, who were relatively well off in a lot of respects, but how their whole culture really depended upon the return of the salmon. And one of the things that does, I think, is to put some of the into some kind of historical and religious perspective the ongoing battles that go on in this part of the world over fish, you know, which, you know, fish is a political issue in the Northwest and has been for a long time. And, you know, I think now, my sense is that now there are better relationships between at least Indians and sport fishermen. I don't know, and I don't have enough people that I know in the commercial fishing community to know, you know, how they're faring in this whole thing. You know, in 1975, we were back in the days of the Indian Wars, practically, on Puget Sound. There were people getting shot, and you know, it was really ugly. Now there's a more of a sense of cooperation out here, but it's, you know, some different attitudes about the fish. You know, the Indians weren't, it was a moneymaker for them, for sure. That was a means of survival, but there was also deep religious significance to the fish as well. So, yes?
I'm not from the Northwest, so I'm asking a simple question.
Yeah.
The Indians, of course, I suppose, one of the basic resources of food was...
Oh, yeah. Fish, right? And it is a major source of income, too, for many Indians in this part of the world, and you know, it's just an ongoing kind of battle. In our Lutheran churches up here, there was a real battle because, for instance, in the Seattle area in Ballard, there were a lot of Norwegian fishermen, you know, who were commercial salmon fishermen, and so they had, you know, a pretty strong view of what ought to happen to those salmon. And then there were other parts of the church that were very sensitive to the Indian people, and you know, there were a few church conventions that got pretty ugly there as people did battle with one another. I know I'm a member of a couple of organizations. One of them is called Oregon Trout, the other one is called Trout Unlimited. And I've seen I've been a member of Trout Unlimited for a number of years, and I've seen the evolution of that organization go from one in which, you know, they were very much anti-Indian, you know, and they would collect money for the court challenge of the Bolt decision and all that kind of stuff, and to try to de-commercialize steelhead out here. And I've seen it go from that to now, there's always efforts to try to take away the Indians' treaty rights to fish, and Trout Unlimited the last couple of years has been supportive of the Indians. And partly, I think, because they were a group that was not just interested in fishing, but they were interested in the life of the resource. You know, it was Trout Unlimited is an organization that at least theoretically would say, if it means no more fish, then nobody ought to fish, which gets them in trouble with commercial fishermen all the time. But I think they started to see that if this thing continued, you know, what people were going to be fighting over was who was going to have the right to the last fish, basically. You know, it was that, I mean, it was just getting worse and worse, and people were saying, it's mine, no, it's mine, you know. And now I think we've sort of turned a corner in which, at least, you know, the game departments and the Indians and the sport fishermen, and again, I can't speak for commercial fishermen because I don't have contact with them, but where there's an effort to try to say, okay, you know, we're stuck with this situation, we're in this together, what can we do to guarantee the fact that the fish will perpetuate themselves rather than, you know, spending all the money in court, you know, fighting each other. And I think it's a much more hopeful situation than it used to be. It's not, by no means is it totally defused, though. You know, if some of you know commercial fishermen, you could maybe speak to it, because I know that they sometimes they figured the commercial fishermen, I know, felt like the Indians and the sport fishermen were gonna combine to ace out the gill netters and other people like that, and they were gonna bear the brunt of it. Other people, we still have 12 minutes of tape left for posterity. Yeah.
I'd like to ask how this experience of watching the whales would actually change somebody's life. How I can't quite understand the mechanics of the progression or the theory.
I can't speak about the whales. I can speak about the salmon experience, which I gather from what you said is a little bit similar. I think that, I guess I could oversimplify this. You know, you have experiences in your life that are real powerful experiences sometimes. You know, they move you in a way that you can't explain. But you don't have any way to interpret them. Or at least a lot of times you don't have any means of interpreting them immediately. You know, something amazing will happen to you and you'll say, this is really amazing, but I don't know what it means. I can't figure it out. I think what happened for me is that, this was something that I was deeply moved by in a way that I can't explain. And then gradually, as, reflecting on it and reading some more and understanding some more, I was able to put it in some kind of perspective and interpret the experience, okay? In other words, I was, somebody else might have the same thing happen to them that happened to me, but because they're a different person and because they interpret it differently, it wouldn't have the same effect on them, I tried to interpret this experience by means of Christian theology, and then I tried to interpret Christian theology by means of this experience so that they work with each other, but... it's hard to explain the immediate, it's almost an intuitive kind of thing that, you're in the middle of something and you say, I don't know what this is, but it's big. Have you had that feeling before?
just the huge symbols that are going on in life.
Yeah.
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 Birth.
Yeah.
Conception.
Yeah. Yeah.
We think of those things, but
you don't
experience.
Yeah.
And watch.
Sure. Seeing, and the thing about this was that you see it so quickly. It's happening in a relatively short period of time. Whereas in a human life, a lot of times in your family and stuff, birth, death, and all of those kinds of things that help you to figure out what's going on in your life. They take place over a protracted period of time, and so.
And you're busy with other things.
Yeah, you're watching other stuff. Who do you respect? One of the reasons why I think, we need to respect the wisdom of older people is because they've lived through some of these cycles, so they've had a chance to reflect on them, And a lot of cultures respect the religious elders. The elders have a very prominent role, and I think part of it is just because of that. They've been around long enough, and they've seen enough things happen, and so they have a way of interpreting it, In our culture, if you're in our church, if you're a pastor over the age of 55, you have a heck of a time trying to get a call, It's like somebody finally gets to the point where they know what's going on and we don't want them anymore,
John, you were talking about when you saw the salmon spawning.
Yeah.
It was a very awesome experience.
Yeah,
And of course, different people have different times, different places where they
right,
have
absolutely.
That experience. I guess the hymn that comes to my mind that kind of reflects that is Earth and All Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And different people,
sure.
Not just in nature and so forth, have experience. And I guess I can remember talking in Bible classes with people who said, shared what was the most awesome experience that they had. A lot of people talked about the birth of their child.
Right.
Other people talked about, I remember one lady talking about holding her mother in her arms as she was about to die. She was very frail and so forth. I guess what I would like to say a little bit more about, you had the experience with the salmon. And certainly all of us want, as individuals, to have those kinds of experiences more frequently than we do it, every day.
Yeah.
And certainly we want to be of help to people that seem to go through life without having that kind of awe that ought to be a part of every day. And I wondered if you've given some thought to what it is that enables certain people to go through life with a kind of openness, eyes open, ears open, to really see life, even in ways that you can't describe in words. What keeps certain people from doing that, other people from doing it more? How can we help ourselves?
Well, I guess that relates to the whole area that I'm real interested in, which is the role of experience in theology. And I think in Lutheran circles, in the circles that I grew up in, we're sort of mistrustful of experience in a sense, you know. And there's some good reasons for that. You know, Christ is really present in the body and blood at Holy Communion, whether you feel that way or not. It's not dependent upon your feeling about it, you know. And we say that as a means of comfort to people, which I think is very important. On the other hand, I think we sometimes take that to such an extreme that we ignore experience, we don't trust it, we don't, when somebody comes into, you know, the pastor's office and says, I've had a religious experience, a lot of times we say, shh, don't tell anybody, you know, it's dangerous, we try to cover it over. So I think one of the things we can do is to be more open to accepting people's experiences when they tell us about it. The other thing, I guess, is it's, you know, I have a real sense of grace, I guess, in that, you know, this was something that just kind of hit me, you know, out of the blue. It was a gift. I mean, it wasn't something that I was particularly looking for, I don't think, and it was just something that just kind of happened to me and as a gift. And I think there's a sense in which there are ways we can make ourselves more open, to open our eyes to what's going on around us, yes, but I think there's another sense in which, you know, God's presence comes to us, you know, and I want to say that this was a way in which God was present in a special way for me, but in which that's a, you know, that kind of comes to you as a gift, and it just, you know, I don't know what you do to, grace is uncontrolled, you know, Jesus says in John, the Spirit blows where it wills in some ways. I'm not saying that there aren't ways that we can open ourselves up more to seeing those kinds of things. And I guess I would say, you know, one of the ways I think that we as pastors can help people with that is to be more, you know, to somehow swallow hard when somebody says they have a religious experience, and to try to accept that, you know, from the person, and not assume that they're some, you know, charismatic kook, you know, and they're going to go off and, you know, do something crazy, but that you know, to try to help them interpret it. Yeah.
There's all kinds of varied experiences. Once I was with a family, but I had about 9 children, and the father was dying.
Uh-huh.
We were in the hospital, and those people, the family had really not been that close, and were kind of far apart, but they'd come together for this experience in the hospital, and the father dying, and at the point of almost at death, and the father still being conscious, the whole family, we gathered around the bed, we held each other in our hands, or, you know, held close to each other, and had a prayer of release. And that dying experience was just sensed and felt, and the grief was gone. Because that was beautiful. That was a kind of a time when one of the events of life where God was present.
Sure, and I think, you know, that's a good point too, because I think, and again, you know, I'm not sure of all the details on this, but the fact that, for instance, just take a thing like death, which is, you know, it's a very painful process. It's a very, nobody likes death, okay? And yet, if we take that and somehow, you know, remove it from people so that nobody ever talks about it, you know, nobody's there when death happens, what we do, I think, is we lose an opportunity. You know, I talked about that a little bit with loneliness. birth is another example. You know, birth is a Morton Kelsey. Some of you may be familiar with Morton Kelsey, but he talks about, you know, places, experiences where God is somehow especially present, where people sense the numinous presence of God. One of the ways is birth. You know, the fact that babies are born in homes now a little bit more than they used to be, or the fact that fathers get to be there. You know, the fact that in many cases mothers are not, you know, put under when they have the baby, but they're actually there. You know, they experience the pain, and yet, you know, okay, that's an example, I think, of an experience that, you know, you say, well, you know, people die and they're born, you know, big deal, life goes on. But it's more than that. You know, life does go on. I mean, that's it. That's what it's all about, in a sense. And to somehow recognize in those things that may seem sort of ordinary that there's something special there, to look in those places. Yes.
There's an essay by Jacob Bronowski called The Creative Mind, and he talks about making connections.
Uh-huh.
It's an essay about scientists and poets, that they do the same thing.
Huh.
That you can look at an apple falling off a tree and think of gravity.
Yeah.
Or you can look at a rose and think of Juliet. Making those connections. And this end of his essay then ends with the fact that in making those connections, we become co-creators with God.
Mm-hmm.
We see things in a new light and we create something new. You saw the salmon and you've created an article.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in seeing connections among things, and we're aware of connections, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look at something and just think of how that connects to something else that we know, or maybe listen until it does connect to something else that we know. Or learn.
I think that's really helpful. I think that it's not just the experience that's important, because the experience that people have can, you know, a variety of people can have the same experience and all look at it as something different. Part of what it is then that makes it special is the interpretation that you choose to put on it. You know, what categories do you use to see what's happening there? How is someone dying in a hospital like that? You know, say, you know, you have a way of interpreting that, because we talk about dying every time we're in church together. You know, we talk about Christ's death. And so we have a way, you know, a mythology, if you will, not in the sense of something that's false, but as the sense of a big story that helps us to make the little stories in our life make some sense. And I think that's part of the way that you know, our experiences start to make some sense too, is that, you know, we're relating it to our big story, you know, death and life. The salmon spawn and die and bring life to the valleys. Oh yeah, Jesus does that too. So that helps me understand the salmon, and it also helps me understand, and the salmon helped me understand Jesus, and they, you know, the experience and the interpretation help to, you know, it's kind of a cycle that they go through with each other. And I guess if there's anything that I hope that happens as a result of all this, you know, from my perspective, is that people will, A, you know, trust their experience a little bit more, and then when they have the experience, to try to interpret it, to try to use what they believe and to use the stories of Christianity to try to help make some sense about it. Because not only does that make the experience make some sense, that helps make Christianity make some sense. I mean, you know, the constant complaint that I hear in my work is that, you know, it's a nice story, but it doesn't make any sense to my life.